Good evening. Welcome to the LSE. My name is Hakan Seçkin Elgin. I work in the school in the Department of Social Policy. Welcome you all to this very important and interesting talk by Stephen Whittle, who is a professor of equalities law at Manchester Metropolitan University. In 1975, age 19, he set up the UK's first local trans support group in Manchester. The same year, he transitioned to living as Stephen. In the 1970s and 80s, he lost many jobs because of being trans. In 1985, he decided things would only change if trans people became lawyers. He qualified in law in 1990 and in 1992. He was a co-founder of Press for Change, the UK's transgender lobbying group. PFC fought cases at the European Court of Justice and the European Court of Human Rights to gain legal recognition for trans people in the Gender Recognition Act 2004. In 2010, PFC also achieved full protection for trans people under the UK's equality laws. Stephen has been an advisor to the UK, Irish, Italian, Japanese, and South African governments, the Council of Europe, and the European Commission. He advises lawyers and regularly writes court briefs or is an expert witness in courts across the world. In 2015, he was appointed Special Advisor to the Parliamentary Women and Equalities Committee Inquiry into Transgender Equality. In 2005, he was made an Officer of the Order of the British Empire in the Queen's New Year's Honours List for his work on transgender rights. Stephen and his wife Sarah married in 2005 after Stephen gained legal recognition as a man, but have been partners for 37 years. They have four children by donor insemination. The eldest has graduated and is teaching in China. The others are currently at university, and we also have one of them with us tonight. So I'm delighted that he agreed to be with us today, and it's a great honor to be chairing this session. We will be talking about Pressing for Change, 25 Years Seeking Trans Equality. Before I pass the floor to him, I'll ask to mention hashtag LSCLGBT to you, so you can tweet. And also the exhibition for the LGBT History Month in the library at the moment, which you can go and visit, called Glad to Be Gay, Struggle for Legal Equality. So thank you very much for being with us tonight. Over to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's very nice to be invited here, not least because I have an opportunity to spend a day or two with my daughter and go to the V&A exhibition on the 1960s, you know, What's It, Records and Revolution, which sounds really exciting. And they paid the train ticket, so that's fabulous.
It's the least we can do.
It's the least. But it's also an opportunity to perhaps put some of the record straight about what trans activism did and achieved over the period of the last 25 years, particularly the organisation Press for Change, of whom I was part. So I'm going to take us through some of that basic history, but talk about real life in the middle of that as well. I'll take off my watch so you're not still here at 10 o'clock tonight. Otherwise, as my daughter, who's somewhere hidden in this room, would say, God, he'll be here forever. Right, OK, there we are. It's really, really hard to explain what it was like to be trans then as compared to now. I think a few trans people who find they have other ancillary difficulties, so for example they're physically disabled or they have mental health problems, may also have similar experiences. But most trans people nowadays have not, who have transitioned in the last 10 years, will have no real inkling of the experience of people like myself who transitioned in the 60s or the 70s or the 80s. I once described it as being like the stuff that people wiped off their shoes as they entered a building. That was what you felt like. I also remember saying to a colleague as I stood propping up the filing cabinet in her room saying, I don't know why I'm bothering. Christ, if we could sell this campaign, I could set up a factory making dog shit pies and we'd make a fortune. And every now and then she says to me, how's the dog shit pie business going on? Because ultimately the campaign was very successful, but it was not done easily. Partly, we had a set of models that we were able to follow, and most notably, by looking at what feminists had achieved in the 1970s in particular, and looking at how, as particularly those women who'd actively campaigned for changes in law related to, for example, domestic violence, had worked to inveigle their way into parliamentary lives and to get their issues aired and get legal change, we had models to look back on and to build our campaign upon. And we did a lot of reading about, you know, political pressure groups and the theory of political pressure groups, and then we tried to set out and put some of that in practice. I had a period of my life when I wasn't going to be political like this in any way, shape or form. It wasn't a deliberate decision, but having transitioned in the 1970s, it had been sort of knocked into my head repeatedly, and the textbooks had said the same thing, that all transsexual people wanted to do was to get their operation, have their birth certificates changed so they could get married, and then disappear into the ordinary fabric of life. The problem is that wasn't the reality for most people. By the time I got engaged with, or we set up Press for Change, I'd been self-employed for 7 years because over the previous, from 1975 to 1985, I'd lost 7 jobs. I'd also been to university and taken a year out in the middle of it because of the abuse I received. And it's almost impossible to explain how difficult it was when not one piece of paperwork you had could acknowledge your identity or the identity you appeared to have. I mean, even to the extent that by the time I had surgery, my first surgery, chest surgery, in 1979, which was 4 years after I'd transitioned, which wasn't bad, I had seen 6 psychiatrists, all of whom had said they wouldn't treat me. I was being treated entirely because my GP believed me, fundamentally, for which she had got punished as well and had to take a year out of the NHS because she was suspended, just simply because she'd provided me with hormone treatment rather than see me dead, as she put it. And when I went for that chest surgery, I had to see another psychiatrist. And my partner, Sarah, and I went along, and his questions to me were, how often have you enjoyed group sex? And I was sort of 24 at the time, and it wasn't actually something that had been anywhere upon my agenda at all. And then he asked my wife repeatedly how many women she'd slept with. And she sort of kept saying, I've not slept with any women. He said, but you keep saying you've had relationships before, Stephen. And she said, yes, with men. Yeah. There was a fundamental inability to believe who we were. For about 14 years, I'd led my life fairly privately. I'd been involved with support organisations. I'd done my time on the telephone lines. I was very, very happy being treasurer of organisations or secretary or anything like that, but I didn't want to do the television or the radio or the magazines or anything like that. And you have to excuse me, I've got a terrible sort of runny nose at the moment, the ends of a cold. But what happened in 1991 was that Sarah said she would like to try to have a baby, which meant we needed to get fertility treatment. We spoke to our general practitioner, who suggested that when I was out of the room, of course, that he would have an affair with Sarah so she could get pregnant. So he was dumped. We went to 3 different services. Finally, one of them agreed to treat. So the NHS provision just wouldn't even answer the letters. One of them agreed to treat us. That was the British Pregnancy Advisory Service, which had just started a service providing fertility treatment to single women. And the Sun newspaper, just as we were about to start, had a big headline saying, BPAS provides woman with sperm to have virgin birth. Because apparently she'd not had a sexual relationship with anybody, so the BPAS had to close the service just like that. Another guy kept talking about my babies and my ladies and my mums, as he put it, and he wouldn't like me in the room when he was doing the insemination, which was a bit freaky, and we had the biggest row ever on the way home from that clinic, as you can imagine. Finally, we went to see somebody. He was a nice guy. And I'll say his name, Stanley Lieberman. He ran the Manchester Fertility Services. He saw us. He listened to us. We went back a week later. He'd read every possible textbook there was about trans people. He knew all about my hormone treatment, everything. You know, we'd not really gone into that in any depth. And he was said, I'm absolutely happy to treat you too. You've taken time over this decision. You've had counselling, you know, everything else. Yeah. I'm all for it, but it has to go before my ethics committee. By this time, I'd actually finished my law degree, which I'd done part-time in the evenings, and I was doing started a part-time master's at Manchester Met. I was aware that there were people I was working with in the department who actually sat on that ethics committee for Manchester Fertility Services. And I'm sure if you'd said to them, should Stephen and Sarah be allowed to have a baby, they'd say, yeah, sure, they'd be great. But because we became Mr. A and Miss B, the letter came back, of course, and what it said, not directly in this language, but what it said was, this woman will never be good enough for us to allow her to become a mother while she's in love with it. And that was the point when, I can't tell you, you know, I was so angry. I've always said, you know, thump me, that's fine, thump my partner, you know, you'll get this one back. And it's sort of that same thing. I could not believe the sheer manner in which they cut her off. Not me, her, because she loved me. And that was unbelievable. I remember thinking, hold on a minute, I've just spent 6 years doing a part-time law degree, I've done a master's, you know, I'm now doing a PhD, surely I ought to not take this lying down. I remember us going to the library and getting the books out, and this was pre-computer access, of course, and ploughing through Archbold and various legislative textbooks until we found a particular case, and we found that the legislation actually afforded us a right to appeal that decision, though the clinic itself had no idea of that. And they said, no, you haven't, and we said, we'll go to court, and we get to Minchell Street, and they go, OK. You know, at the doors of the court, their barrister had done the reading and gone, you know what? The decision says you cannot cut off a group of people. It's like saying we won't treat people who are Jewish. It's exactly and precisely the same. Mm. You know, and, you know, A month later, Sarah had treatment and we had the first of four children. But it made me realise that we needed to do something. Mark Rees, who's based down here, he'd, a few years earlier, having spent much of his life very involved actively with the Anglican Church, had been rejected from possible training for the priesthood, for the Anglican priesthood, because he was legally female. I mean, he said, this is ridiculous, you know, I spent 4 years in the Navy as a Wren and was thrown out because I might be a lesbian, even though I'd never actually had a sexual relationship with anybody. And now they're not letting me train to be a minister for the church because, you know, I might influence other people. It's all supposition. And what he did do was arrange for us to go here, the House of Commons, and we had a meeting with Alex Carlisle, who was then MP. This was a monumental day. Six of us went. We travelled in a herd for probably the first time ever in English life or UK life. Trans people didn't walk the streets together before that. We met in places, but we never, ever walked together in case somebody could see and guess what you were by virtue of being together. So three very tall women and three very short men not only walked through Parliament Square, but we walked into the lobby of the House of Commons, and then somebody took us into a very nice office where they gave us tea and biscuits. And it was like that sensation of, you know, I can't believe it. It was so actually somebody can actually believe that we're human beings, that we're not monsters, that, you know, they're not going to be tainted by contamination. Alex Carlisle was great and he was very practical. He said, if you want to do something, you need to actually act. You need to create an organisation that acts. You need to have a very professional organisation. You need to clearly state your agenda. Most importantly, he said, at that time, don't use the word transsexual in the title. We didn't have transgender in 1992, note, or rather occasionally you saw it in odd bits of American literature, but not here. Don't use the word transsexual, because if you want anybody to read the stuff that you produce, that mustn't be there on the front page, because they just chuck it in the bin. Make yourself very visible as citizens and tell your story over and over again until it's understood. And in fact, if you look and do any research now, between 1992 and about 1999, you will see millions and millions of words were written about trans people here in the UK, because we did something quite unusual. We would ring up, for example, the News of the World, the bane of our lives, as I'm sure you can imagine, but we'd ring up the Women's Health page editor, and we'd say, would you like a story about a transsexual? And they'd say, yes, how much? And we'd say, for free, but one condition. We don't want to edit, but we want to make sure that our words are put in context as we say them, not as you want to, you know, infer from them. And initially, it was just three or four of us who ever did that, but gradually, over the years, the impetus grew as other trans people realised we hadn't actually, you know, died or turned purple as a consequence of telling our story in public. People got the courage to do so. But we set up, we literally crossed the road from the House of Commons, went to a cafe that existed, Granny's Cafe, and we said, right, okay, we need to do this. He told us we've got to send a letter to every Member of Parliament coming in what was then about to be an election. Everybody who arrives at their desk should have this letter. That means we need a bit of money. What have you got? We piled, you know, cheques in of our spare money and managed to pull together about 500 quid between the six of us. And we created this organisation, which we came through the name Press for Change, because one of the things we wanted to do was change the press. They were the bane of our lives. But we also, you know, the very fact that it was about changing and it was about being a pressure group and all that was sort of led to the name. And the name stuck, you know, somehow, and has become well recognised. Our initial logo was that. As you can see, the logo isn't that any longer because, you know, when we did this, it was about people changing sex, going from one gender sex role or gender role to the other. We used to say it's about gender, not sex. It's about gender, not sex. And ultimately, you know, we recognised as the years went on that as this was about gender, this was a rather limiting logo to have. One of the things we needed to do was find out what the problems were. I read 201 legal papers in 1992. 200 of them talked about transsexual people wanting to have operations, get their birth certificates changed so they could get married without telling their married partner and then disappear into society. Only one ever mentioned anything else, and that was a paper by David Panic, which happened to have two paragraphs on employment rights. However, the research we did with the community showed that people's issues were very different. I mean, I can remember one woman saying to me, she said, "Stephen, look at me." She said, "No, really look at me. I look like a trucker in a frock. Do you really think conventional marriage is ever going to be of any importance in my life?" And I said, "It's a negative description." She said, "But it's the truth at the moment." And she said, "I may never look like a conventional woman. You know, I'm a transsexual woman. That's what I am. I'm a transsexual woman. You know, I'm not a woman. I'm a transsexual woman." And it was such a lesson for me, having come through the route way of being, you know, a miserable child, a deeply unhappy and suicidal teenager, to becoming what the doctors called a transsexual, and getting through that to becoming what I thought was a man. You know, it was a very important lesson to be sort of knocked back and told, you know, let's stop and really think about this. What are we? We are something different, but is there any shame in that? But what people talked about as being important, well, I put them in the wrong order here probably because I was doing this late last night. The thing that was highest on people's priority was equal access to employment. People lost jobs. Poof, the minute they transitioned, they're out of work. If by any chance they were in sufficiently higher position to stay in work, they didn't get promotion ever again. Most of them got retired off early, and lots of them actually got downgraded. They got pushed and pushed and pushed out. One person I knew ended up working by themselves in a room 40 miles away from the rest of the business. A woman who worked for a supermarket called Asda, that was a cough, actually ended up being placed in the car park, in that little box out in the car park where they sort of supposedly check your tickets, but nobody's ever in there. That was her changing room. You know, she wasn't allowed to keep her stuff with anybody else. The second issue was personal safety. The volume, the amount of abuse people took in public and in private, 93% of the respondents to the first survey we did had been physically abused. Most significantly, over almost 20% had been physically assaulted, the equivalent of a criminal offence, in their workplaces if they had transitioned in work. And not one person was still working in the same industry or the same business as they had transitioned in. And we did not have one person who'd had any increase in salary unless they were self-employed at this point. Fifthly was access to medical provision. It was a nightmare. If you didn't fit the model of what you were meant to look like, you know, according to the book, and there was one book, you know, Harry Benjamin's book on transsexualism, and you were all meant to fit this model of that. If you didn't fit that, you didn't get anything. But at the same time, the doctors complained all the time that we told them lies and not true stories. But, you know, when I first saw the doctor, I was 18, naive, and he said, you know, question arose, and I said, well, I'm not sure what my sexual orientation is. You know, maybe I'm bisexual. And that was it. I was thrown out immediately. You know, somebody like you is not going to be treated here. And it was impossible to say that. I didn't know. I'd not had an experience with anybody at that point. All I knew was men looked terribly handsome, and I fell in love with women, you know. Of course I was confused. Obviously, a crucial element to all of this was the failure of privacy. The fact that you never had privacy in any way, shape or form about your background. This medical history of yours, and we were talking about the medical history, was public property, you know, that anybody could use and abuse as they felt like. And we realised that in order to deal with all of that, we had to make massive changes in public attitudes. So the campaign problems, you know, this is like six people sat in a room. I think by this stage we're about 10 of us. And we sort of pulled this off from the record. The campaign problems we saw was we had no money. We had a dreadful public image. The social stigma against us as individuals was awful. And the community we worked with was massively diverse, if we could reach them at all. Yeah, I mean, I wrote many years ago about the use of computers by the community, not least the fact that nobody would have the internet but for trans women who were very instrumental in developing that technology, but that we were amongst the first people to actually use computers in the home to create magazines, to use this thing called what was originally, you know, online conversations. I don't even remember what we called it, but you were what you wrote. But what we realised from doing that was that we had this hugely diverse community. The presentation of us that appeared in the medical texts were far removed from the truth, very far removed from the truth of who we were like, what we were like. We also realised that the community did not exist of people who were homosexual, people who were transsexual, people who were transvestites. That actually people melded and crossed. A lot of people who were cross-dressers would later on in life desire to transition. A lot of people who transitioned and presumed that they were always going to be heterosexual in their new gender role had fallen in love with somebody of the other gender. And it was this massive diversity. So how did we organise all of this? So what did we do? Well, first of all, it became absolutely crucial that we listened to all the community. If we were going to have a mandate to speak on people's behalf, we had to listen to everybody, which meant we had to learn about each other, we had to learn about the diversity within the community and be open to that diversity. We tried to create a very flat grassroots organisation. I remember once going in the States talking to people about how we worked, how flat we were, and how successful this very loose organisation of sort of almost cells had worked. And I told them all about this, and then they got up and they talked about, we need to appoint treasurers for this, and we need to appoint, you know, regional this. I thought, yeah, you know, it was called It's Time America, and, you know, It's Time America lasted about a year, you know, because they simply didn't get it. That loose cell structure was really important to enabling individuals to participate. And one of the ways we did that was ask people to do very, very small things. The first thing we ever asked the community to do was write a letter to the Member of Parliament. We put the top bit in, we put the bottom bit in, saying thank you very much. And we said, you don't need to sign it. All you have to do is say, yeah, I'm a constituent. And what we'd like you to do is write in the middle, only on one side, what it's been like for you. It took us 4 years, but in 4 years we had every Member of Parliament written to by a constituent who was trans. We got to the point where we even had John Major, who was then Prime Minister, actually lobbying on behalf of six people in his constituency for their clinical treatment by asking people to just engage on that very small level. And one of the things you may have seen over the years more recently is the increasing number of trans people appearing within local and parliamentary political organisations. They've been around for years. They've done the donkey work for years. They've sat in constituency offices filing leaflets into envelopes. They got engaged. Once people spoke to their Member of Parliament, wrote that letter, then they put their name on the letter, then they went to visit them, and a relationship started. And now we have, you know, a very active community engaged with politics at every level, local and national. Crucial to all of this was a very committed, what I call the management team. We weren't a team, a management team. We were about five of us who had computers in the corners of our bedrooms, and because we had the computers, we did the management. If you can imagine. We had the computers and we did the management, and we became the hub for communication. Which also gave us a responsibility to start to think about policies and practices and rules and how it would all work, and to put a professional layer on top of that. There was a lovely piece in 2002 leaked to us by the Daily Mail, of all people, who sent us a thing from South Yorkshire Police that talked about Press for Change and its offices in Manchester and Brighton, and that sounds ever so grand for five bedrooms with computers in. But they clearly thought we did have something much bigger than existed. So, we needed to educate our community and everyone else. In 1996, we set up the Press for... 1995, I think, was the first version, the very first draft of the Press for Change website. By 1999, this was the biggest political website in the world. That was its position in 1999. Over 1,000 pages, 100,000 hits each month, 1 million plus visitors, and all free to the community, not just here in the UK, but worldwide. And what were the requirements of doing this? Selfless commitment. You had to be prepared to give up everything, and I mean everything sometimes it felt like. You had to have total discipline and complete integrity. And I would say to anybody ever thinking of doing pressure group politics, what goes on out there often seems to lack all of those things completely. But what worked for us was by having complete integrity, no post-truth or lies, as it's put. And one of the reasons that did work was because when we went into the room to talk to people involved in politics, policy development and government, we were able to tell them the truth of our lives, which were pretty grim, but we were also able to present it as very, very real as well, by not over-exaggerating. But important to do that, we had to reconcile our own philosophies. And I've seen other organisations throughout the world actually fail on this very point. As trans people, that question of seeking respect and equality for all trans people was absolutely crucial. I have seen organisations crash because one trans person decides that only transsexual people who are going to have surgery are real men or women. And, you know, God almighty. And I have to say, there was an occasion I even had to come down to a group here in London and say, you can say what you like about what you think a trans man is, but I started this, so therefore it's my right to say what it is. So you can cut it, you know. This incredible need to reconcile philosophies and value the rights of all, and learning how to compromise and discover common values. And all of that could only be done with ultimately email being there at the core of it. We worked with a whole variety of other national organisations, worked very hard. Press for Change actually set up Gyres, which is now a charity dealing with medical research, science and such like around trans people. Mermaid deals with young trans people and family. This creation of a network in the early 1990s through to the late 1990s was crucial in ensuring that we could engage the whole community. And one of the things we did as Press for Change was everybody who joined one of these organisations, and you didn't really join, there wasn't a membership fee, but anybody who participated in one of these organisations automatically became a member of Press for Change and therefore received all the information about what the community was trying to do to get its own rights. We also worked a lot with other organisations, particularly Liberty, but many other national rights organisations, local social groups for trans people, charities like Mind, for example. The club and bar world was really important to reach many trans people who perhaps otherwise wouldn't, and to work with things like welfare, legal rights agencies. And these were the things that, this was the way we did it. Sorry, I should put that to come through. First of all, we had to change public attitudes, and we did that by telling our stories over and over and over again. We had to change that agenda, and we did that through court cases and legislative change. Now, we were really lucky in that the 1990s and early 2000s, legal aid was still available. So what we used to do was we used to sit in annual general meetings where we got sort of 60 or 100 of the community together, and we'd work out what would be a perfect court case to take. And then we'd say, right, we need somebody who's had this experience, is currently unemployed, is willing to put 5 years of their life over to it and take the risk that they may be made public, then we'll fight for your privacy on that. And we were able to bring case after case after case. Now, what many people don't realise is we lost more cases than we won, but the cases we won were really big ones at the European Court of Justice, giving the right to workplace protection throughout Europe. So that one case in 1996 provided workplace protection probably to, you know, 150,000 trans people at that time. People who didn't even know that they could possibly fight for their rights. We also fought very, very hard to have those court cases embodied in legislation. You do get odd bits like, you know, the sex discrimination gender reassignment regulations. At one point, we got a letter from some government department saying they were holding a consultation on embodying the decision in the European Court of Justice on workplace rights into English law. And this was the consultation document, and we read it and went, what? First of all, they were proposing we shouldn't be let near kids. Secondly, they were proposing we shouldn't be let near anybody who was going to be in a state of personal undress. You know, God's sake. So we counted, well, that's the teachers gone, that's the nurses gone, that's the doctors gone. You know, do they realise? And then you had a whole series of... The ultimate one was that we would be allowed to transition at work and go to the toilet of our preferred gender choice when a senior manager had decided that we looked reasonable enough. And I think that was the sort of, you know, they had really overstepped the mark at that point and made themselves look totally stupid and ridiculous. You know, you explain that to anybody and they went, what? We don't have liquor tests for anybody, you know, in this world. But that was tantamount to what they were saying. You know, lots of cartoons with ladies, gents and buckets labelled for transsexual people here, you know, and things. There was that sort of stuff. But we did a lot of things about changing the way we talked as well. You know, we kept saying, transsexual is an adjective, not a noun. We're transsexual people. We are not transsexuals. We're people, first and foremost. You know, it was very clear from the research I'd done on my PhD just that how we were really regarded as almost less than human in relation to rights that other people had. And all of that, ultimately, was to lead to the Gender Recognition Act. Through the public agenda, we did all that. And I think it's worthwhile putting up this picture of Roy and Hayley. Hayley Cropper, first transsexual character in a soap on British television. Well, yeah, no, second, you know, see them all the time nowadays. But when Hayley appeared in 1997 on Coronation Street, she was the very first. And the reason she was there was because we'd had local trans activists in small groups sit in the bars where scriptwriters from EastEnders, Brookside, what's the farming one? Emmerdale, and Coronation Street. Week after week after week after scriptwriting meetings. Until they started to talk to them. And ultimately, it was Coronation Street who said, you know, we're thinking of doing a story about people like you. Annie Wallace, who's currently on Hollyoaks. She was into amateur dramatics at the time. And she said, do you want any help with that? And they said, no. And the first programme they did, the story was so bad, we all went, wow, what the fuck have you done? Get it right. If you're going to do it, get it right. And Annie was appointed as the Press for Change advisor to Coronation Street. And we sort of pressed Annie and said, go to college, become an actress. Go to college, become an actor. Go to college, become an actor. You know? And she did. And she didn't become an actor for years after that. But and I kept saying to her, it'll come one day. She says, I'll get one of those old, middle-aged ladies, won't I? And I said, probably. But she got the part as a transsexual woman, being the first transsexual person to play a transsexual character in a soap on British television, you know. And she got the BAFTA, got nominated for a BAFTA in the process and everything. But it was all done through collective working, you know, and Julie Hesmondhall was brilliant in her support for us. In terms of court decisions, we went to the European Court of Justice, PNS. We had a whole stash of them, year in, year out. We never missed a year, virtually, at the European Court of Human Rights. X, Y, and Z. Well, it should have been X, Y, Z1, Z2, Z3, and Z4 by the time we actually got the decision, because Z was my eldest daughter, and X and Y were me and Sarah, and we wanted to know why she should not have the right to have her parent on her birth certificate. You know, either I was a parent, and if I was female, then perhaps we should have two mums on birth certificates, and in that case we could have lesbian couples, you know, being acknowledged as parents. And if you don't like that, well, you know, acknowledge me as a dad, or a man, and make me a something, you know, a dad, and therefore a man. In fact, we lost the case, but the court, and it opened up a whole body of jurisprudence afterwards, said that we were a de facto family. We were a family by the very nature of how we lived our lives. And that opened up the jurisprudence of the Court of Human Rights to recognise LGBT families after that. But it took until 2002, in the case of Goodwin and I, before we actually finally won legal rights. So we'll go through there. And that sort of followed on, because with the Haley character, the day Haley wasn't allowed to get married on Coronation Street was the day that Jack Straw, who was then the Home Secretary, announced a government working party into the rights of transsexual people. And I was appointed to it, and 6 sort of months later, I'd still not managed to ever find out where it met. So finally, after a lot of meeting, they said they'd send the chair of the committee to meet us. I remember walking through Westminster Hall, and there was this little old lady, and she was sat on a chair looking really worried. And I said, "You all right? Can I help you?" "Oh, no, no, I'm going into a meeting." "Are you sure you don't need any help?" "No, no, no." And she came in, she was actually the chair of that meeting, and God knows what she was expecting, but she realised we hadn't got tails or horns. And 10 minutes later, of course, we're chatting away. She invites us to the meeting. I took 6 trans people with me. We made sure we had an absolute range of the community. All legally experienced, right through from a woman who looked like a trucker in a frock, through to a very camp young trans man, to really show that we were this really broad community of people. And they gave us 20 minutes, and we left 4 hours later and went to the pub with them. You know, that was the sort of experience we had, was getting them to understand we were real. Ironically, it led ultimately to legislation that, guess what, gave us the right to change our birth certificates and get married. The very thing. But by that stage, we'd already got the employment protection. And what it did do was allow in 2005, particularly, a national conversation to take place. We talked in the last 2 years about there being a tipping point in trans lives, a change. Laverne Cox referred to it as the transgender tipping point. But I think that tipping point was much, much earlier. It was 10 years ago when the Gender Recognition Act enabled other states in the world to see that it could work. The Act is not perfect. It needs a rewrite and an update now, just as the Equality Act needs to move away from language of gender reassignment and be updated now. But at the time those things were done, they were firsts. And consequently, they were never going to be perfect. I remember somebody saying, you know, they're making people get divorced. And I say, yeah, but we've spent weeks actually enabling you to get divorced, get your gender recognition certificate, walk down the road and get a civil partnership all in the space of an hour. You know, Jesus, that's some achievement. And the alternative was having nothing. So do I get something that's 95% perfect for 95% of the community, or do we walk away with nothing for anybody? No, so it was those sorts of very difficult decisions. It never meant we supported those things that happened, but it meant that we had to be realistic, recognising the community that we worked with. Now, the consequences of all this are that we see trans lives. You know, I can come and talk to you here, and I'm not frightened walking down the street, and I'm not worried that somebody's going to walk out of this room and tell other people that, guess what, he's had a sex change. It doesn't mean to say, however, it's perfect. I can't think of a year at my university that I've not gone to human resources and said, it doesn't really matter to me, but I'm going to make this complaint because it matters to other people. You know, the electrician did this, your administrator did that, etc. You know, even to the, you know, a student actually thumped me, you know, because I was this. But, you know, we do it, and we continue doing those processes, because it's only by stepping up do we constantly opening the door for other people to step up. Now, one of the things I say now is for trans people, this hard work has meant that people who are articulate and able can transition easily, moderately easily, but effectively, to lead content, progressive, good citizen lives nowadays. They could actually move forward with their lives and have the big adventures that they've always wanted to have. But it does mean that there are people who are left behind, and that is the less articulate and the less able. And sadly, Press for Change is a very small shadow of its former self nowadays, but we still receive on average 5 inquiries a week asking for legal advice and support, and we answer those. But of course we now have a big organisation here in London that has just added the T, and if you ring it up for advice, guess what they do? They give you my number. Because they've never provided legal advice and support for people. They're not that organisation. They provide jobs inside the organisation to do public-facing changing of minds. That's great. But that's not, I still believe, what the trans community essentially needs. It needs something much more grounded than that. And the problem is, the money really has followed the big boys nowadays. You know, so, but consequences of all this, well, as I say, I'm going to skip all that bit because otherwise we'll never get to the very end, which is that in 2005 I married Sarah, with whom I had Z1, Z2, Z3 and Z4. Or rather, she had them and I held her hand. We've now been together 38 years next month. Which is some achievement for anybody nowadays. And, well, it's the best thing that ever happened in my life, but none of this could have ever happened but for the one thing that she did that I still see people not doing nowadays. You know, we had another prisoner last week commit suicide in a prison. She was on suicide watch, so how the fuck did that happen? But on top of that, they're going to have to edit all these fucks out of this podcast, I just realised. There'll be beep. But, more to the point, you know, is the fact that that has happened is a fundamental failure of the systems to provide her with the necessary support. They had somebody who presented without a gender recognition certificate. Why should she have to get one? People only get one if they ever need one. And I please tell young people they need to get one. She was buying her own hormones, you know, off the internet. She probably didn't even know them as a full clinical system that, you know, it's a bit of a pain, but you get through eventually. And instead, she walked into a prison setting and she was a man. They don't ever fundamentally believe us. That is the reality. Trans people are never... You know, my GP said to me the other week, something was said about surgery, a slight problem, and he said, was it worth it, Stephen? And I looked at him and said, would you have done it if you didn't have a dick? And he's like, but that's exactly it, isn't it? That's exactly it, the failure of to actually believe we are who we say we are. It is an incredible, you know, pervasive, institutional, structural problem that is going to take years to resolve. But the way it's resolved is when you have somebody like Sarah who, you know, about 6 weeks into this, she said, well, of course you're a bloke. You know, it was obvious you were always a bloke. I said, well, you know, not when I was a kid. She said, you were the only boy in an all-girls school. And I bet you, you know, if you asked the kids at school, they'd all say that. And years later, 3 years ago, I went to the 40th, you know, anniversary get-together of us leaving school with great trepidation. There were all these 58-year-old women who I didn't recognise in the slightest. Of course, 5 minutes later, they became 17 and 18-year-old schoolgirls again. The minute they opened their voices or moved, you know, they became. And I said to them at one point, well, you know, you lot haven't changed a bit, but at least I've changed. And they said, they just turned to me en masse, they said, "No, Stephen, you haven't." And somebody said, "There is one big difference. We've talked about this. There's one big difference." I said, "What's that?" They say, "You smile and laugh a lot now." And, you know, Sarah's belief in me was what gave it. And that, I think, is the final lesson. Until people believe we are what we say we are. And it doesn't matter what you think we are, and it doesn't really matter if I formulate it in some binary gendered system, you know. But if I know I'm that person and that's the only way for me to live a good life, that should be sufficient. I am neither, I'm not my gender, I'm just Stephen. And that should be enough for anybody over anything. Thank you.
Thank you. While Stephen is having a water, I just want to do something I forgot to do. I just want to mention that this event is hosted by LSE Library and LSE Spectrum, which is the LGBT plus staff network in the school. And over to you, questions and views and comments. Yes, please, immediate hand. There's a microphone coming.
Is that where you have to stand and shout loud?
You said it's relatively or comparatively easy for people who are articulate to transition now. But I've read a lot...
Articulate and able.
And able to transition now. But I've read a lot about NHS waiting lists and people being told, you know, it's going to be 10 years. I'm not sure whether that's right. If people are on waiting lists for very many years, it's not easy for them to transition through the NHS.
Well, it depends what we mean by living life, you see. It's whether we base our existence around operations. It doesn't mean to say that that should be in any way, shape or form not considered an important aspect of a person's life. I, like you, I was told 15 years, you know, and it was only because I had problems that somebody said to me, "Oh, when did you have your chest surgery done?" I went, "Oh, I've been told there's another 12 years on the waiting list." And I went, "What?" You know, "Oh, God's sake, we'll get that sorted out." That was when I had a hysterectomy in my chest done. And I say that, but the surgeon who was doing my chest walked out halfway through the operation, saying it was suddenly against his, you know, moral values to do this. And I was actually in there for 8.5 hours while people were running around the hospital to get somebody to finish off the surgery. You know, my wife thought I'd died. In fact, the nursing staff on the ward were obviously pretty scared that I died down there. Those things, they're not right. But the question is, ultimately, there are huge problems with the provision that we have. Partly it is about getting the next generation of doctors through so that we get rid of the old lags, some of whom I think have problems themselves, and get into moving into a much more efficient service without masses of time. Why are those people even seeing a psychiatrist? Their doctor can assess, their local GP is trained to assess whether a person has a mental illness. If somebody's clearly sane and organised and able to say, "This is how I know my life should be better," then, you know, treat them with hormone therapy. They'll either hate it and they'll want to come off it, or they'll like it and they'll be happy with it. A year later they could see the surgeon who says, "I'd like to have another assessment," if he wasn't sure. You know, why should I, you know, as I say, the bit of me that's insane is so small. Clearly I'm not, you know, I've done this, I've become a professor of law, I worked in the building trade, you know, and cleaned toilets at points in my life, and I'm still here and sound, and I hope I've been a good parent. and a good citizen. But it's about, it's not that we should value surgery any less, but that we should value people's lives more, so that as we hit those buffers, it doesn't devalue who they are. We shouldn't be saying to somebody, you're only a man or you're only a woman because you look a certain way or because you've been given a certain treatment. I think that's really important. And what I notice now is that the people who are articulate and able, well, many of them partly fund themselves through some of that treatment, many, which they shouldn't have to do, but they keep their jobs, they negotiate their way through their lives. They're not, on the whole, being left homeless in the way that, for example, I see trans asylum seekers, you know, and other groups of people who are disabled. You know, I was working with somebody with who's a paraplegic the other week who'd lost his housing. And the reason he'd lost his housing was because he was using his rent to buy hormone treatments. You know, and actually, when we got to his GP and explained the problem, the GP said, well, wasn't the hospital providing them? You go, no. OK, we'll sort that one out now. We get it done. But that requires an organisation to come in and sort that out. That shouldn't be happening at all. But it is happening. Whereas other people who are, you know, articulate and able tend to be able to surmount those problems themselves.
I'd add rich to that, or reasonably well off. Because if you can afford to pay for it yourself, that's a whole
absolutely
different story.
Yeah, no, absolutely. One of the people giving evidence at the recent Women's Inequalities Inquiry was a partner in PricewaterhouseCoopers and said, everybody should go to India. You know, the surgery I had there was fabulous. Well, you happened to have the money, the time, you know, the nous to get the right surgeon, etc. But that wouldn't happen to most other people who didn't have all of those things. So it's graded. But it is, even so, what we see as a system where there is more opportunity for people to achieve. The very fact that we see huge numbers of people transitioning, and the very fact that nowadays schools ring us up for advice rather than just saying no, is a huge change.
Yes, please.
Hi, I'm Dinesh. I work at the British Medical Association in the Equality, Inclusion and Culture Unit, and I specialise in trans issues, or issues affecting both trans doctors and trans healthcare service users. One of the key things that we're planning to take forward in the coming session with our Medical Ethics Committee is issues affecting LGBT detainees, and issues affecting their healthcare and health issues that they have. But I was just wondering what your picture is of the experiences of both trans asylum seekers and trans people of colour.
Poor. Poor, generally. Some trans people of colour, depending upon family support and community support, particularly family support, you know, can cope with the problems that come along their way. Lots don't. Trans asylum seekers, it's a whole different kettle of fish. And one of the problems we have with the, say, for example, Dublin Treaty, and the idea that people should be sent back to the country into which they entered Europe, there are very few safe countries in the remainder of Europe that are anywhere like as safe for trans people as there are here. How many murders a year do we see of trans people in the UK? One? Maybe. In Italy, it's 64, 65 a year, most of whom actually are asylum seekers. And why are they working in prostitution as asylum seekers? Because they have to have surgery before they can even legally change their name. You know, all of those issues come up. So, you know, this is one of the safest places, but you put somebody in a detention centre here, immediately the staff start ribbing them. Then the rest of the people in the detention centre start ribbing them. Some don't. You know, I've seen people go into particularly Home Office local accommodation who've had wonderful support from the people they've been sharing with, but others which have had terrible experiences. again, one of the key issues is getting out there and having the conversation. And one of the problems we have with detention, with incarceration in prisons, is nobody. You know, we offer them training for free, and they won't let us in to do it. So, you know, it's not like we're asking money for it, but they won't let us in to do it because they don't want it, because they don't believe us. That's the core. And the number of times I've seen it said, oh, well, you know, people, when they're in detention or they're asylum seekers, they say they want a sex change because they think they'll get a better deal that way. Oh, I've known a lot of guys say, I get my dick cut off because that gives me a better deal in Nick, you know. It just, get real. But it's over and over and over again you see this absolute, you know, assertion that people are not what they say they are. And if they are going to be acknowledged in any way, that they're only doing it in order to gain some advantage and so on and so forth.
I will have the last two questions together, and then I think Stephen can respond to them. Yes, there is one there, and then the lady there. Yeah.
Thanks so much. That was fantastic. I wanted to ask if you thought there was a chance in the future for kind of legal change and social change around people with kind of non-standard genders, because it seems just really legally complex to me.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that has happened has, and we particularly saw it with last year's parliamentary inquiry into trans people, 50% of the people who responded to that inquiry identified their gender as non-binary or non-gendered. I wasn't surprised in the slightest. We've just spent 25 years theorising that gender is nothing other than a tool of oppression. It's a tool, it's a social construction that's used there to oppress certain parts of the, you know, 50% of the world first and the rest of us after. Right, so, you know, if gender isn't real other than for those things, you know, perhaps we can move beyond it. And clearly trans people themselves think about this, the whole question of gender, a lot. They read a lot and they start to see that it's not really real other than as a way. It's either a tool of oppression or it's a way in which we can express ourselves and who we are. I remember years ago over a curry, a drunken curry with PhD students, and one of them said, So, Stephen, tell me, what are you? And I said, well, do you want, you know, the Encyclopedia Britannica version, you know, or do you want the couple of sentences? It doesn't matter. You know, it's very complicated. You know, I was born a baby. I was a really unhappy child, I was a deeply miserable, suicidal teenager, and then I started living as Stephen, and I became happy and content, and I fought some battles, and eventually, guess what, I'm here. I'm okay. But that doesn't define me. You know, those things define me, but it doesn't, you know, the idea of the label that goes with it. So I said, in terms of gender, I haven't the faintest idea what I am any longer, because I don't fundamentally believe in it as other, anything other than a means of oppression or a tool, you know, a way in which we can gloriously express ourselves. The complications of sex and the body of the sex of the body is a different question entirely. And so you get this secondary question, well, if then we had true equality between the genders or the sexes, we had true equality, would transsexual people want to transition nowadays? I said, I don't know. I don't know how I'd feel about that. All I know is that when I saw my first French teacher at school with his glorious ginger beard, I thought, I want to be one of those. Not that I want to have one of those. I want to be one of those people who had that. That was like me. Somehow, it's all in front of me. The only adult version of me I could imagine. Every time I tried to imagine the alternative, it just stopped. was blank. People said to me, well, don't you, you know, girls at school would say, don't you imagine, you know, what it's going to be like when you're a housewife and a mother? Look at them and think, Jesus, how weird is that? You know? It was never, that whatever bit in my brain was meant to imagine that bit didn't exist. It imagined something else, the French master and his life. And that's exactly what I've ended up being, you know, ginger beard, well, not any longer, teacher, you know, and hopefully moderately good at that, which he was, my aspiration in life. But it was, you know, that framework of creation of the self. I don't know why the bit that imagined being a housewife and a mother didn't exist, but it never did exist. And nobody, they used to say to us, you know, if we could give you a pill that would make you happy tomorrow, completely happy, but you'd be a girl, would you take it? And so, do you know, that's the most stupid question I've ever heard, because you haven't got the pill. And if you had the pill, guess what? Like anybody, I'm sure that most of us would take it just to be happy. You know, we wouldn't give a damn what we look like at the end of it. Because it's that nature of happiness, you know. But, so it was an illogical approach. We approach gender, you know, without a proper, aggressive logic put to actually what it is and why people should be allowed to develop a personal, you know, to have that personal autonomy that comes with human rights to grow themselves as a human being and to be the best person they can be.
Thank you. The last question. Could it be brief? Because I'm told we are all
sorry,
the time.
Sorry, we're out, and, you know. And, my fault.
I don't want to keep people waiting too long.
I'll try. Beyond the circumstance of people not believing that we are what we say, I have a feeling it's not inability. I have a feeling that at least half the time it's
deliberate.
Yes. There is also the circumstance everywhere of the stuff you were talking about from the 70s continuing to happen in spite of the fact that we have legal protection, because these same people also simply refuse to believe that the law is the law.
Absolutely. I have no doubts about that.
I was at an event recently where, relative to transgender asylum seekers, but I think it's relevant to everywhere, including pub toilets. It was a law event. I think you might have been there. There was a lawyer who, this could have been out of self-interest, but I'm looking for an opinion, who said, look, they've had 6 years. They've had, in many cases, more than 6 years. We've been asking politely, and right next door, the same thing happens. And right next door, the same thing happens. It's time to stop trying to politely persuade every single business, institution, etc., individually, one-on-one in the country. The only thing that seems to work is if you sue them for big money and hit them hard in the wallet and make them scared, and this is what we need to start now.
Absolutely. I totally support the view that more people should take the matters to court. I'm very aware that for many of the people Press for Change works with who struggle in life, that perhaps court is not necessarily the best thing. You know, so I might negotiate a holiday in Spain instead, because they need a bloody rest after what's been done to them, you know, and a few extra bits. But that's about that individual. But where people, you know, have the nous and the ability, they really should take their cases to court. You know, I have no doubt whatsoever that even though Sarah and I lost that case in X, Y, and Z, it was the best thing we ever did. It made us change as individuals in terms of our understanding about our rights. I remember her saying, after it had been blasted all over the radio, you know, that we'd lost our case, etc., and she went to pick our son from nursery, And she said, you know, Stephen, I walked down the street and I was suddenly thinking, shit, that's it, that's it. We're out whether we like it or not. And she said, I got to the crossing and I thought, well, if they don't like it, they can stuff off. And she got to the nursery and the whole group, everybody was stood there going, and they were, you know, so supportive and so positive, and they'd become friends for life to her now and have continued the letter writing and the campaigning with us for the years that went, for the later years that went on, particularly over the Equality Act and such like. But it is, and the Gender Recognition Act, but it is about people being prepared, the community being prepared to work hard and do their homework and go to court.
Thank you. Thanks very much for an extraordinary talk. Thank you.